our guests now. His invention, his innovation rather, is front and centre at Expo 2020 in Dubai. Product inventor Kane Horsham's architectural product Kane Mail is the striking centrepiece of Expo 2020's entrance canopy in Dubai. Of course, like anything, many things, the 2020s become 2021. Kane Mail's mesh is patented and named after its creator, with a nod to chainmail worn by soldiers in the Middle Ages. Kane Horsham grew up in Wairarapa, and his first professional creative job was an ad for McDonald's. He's previously worked at Weta Workshop. During his time as the artistic director of Creatures, Armour and Weapons on the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Kane Mail made its debut. Since then, the mesh, which is made in Petone, has been adapted to all sorts of architectural purposes and is in global demand. It not only forms the canopy at Expo 2020 in Dubai, but also adorns the New Zealand pavilion there. Kia ora, Kane. Welcome to 9 to Noon.
Oh, kia ora, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Great to have you here. Now, your mission is to explain to people in words what Kane Mail is, and then we can talk about its various applications.
Okay. So in a nutshell, it's essentially a modernised version of chainmail, as you alluded to previously. And we've designed it specifically for the use in architectural applications ranging from building facades, spatial dividers, full protection type applications. So it's very structural as well as aesthetic, and also being used more and more now in more large scale artistic installations or as a solar reduction material on buildings in hot climates.
This is really interesting. What does it provide as a sort of a barrier to thermal and solar impacts in hot climates? What are the properties that mean it can mitigate and in fact even reduce the need for air conditioning in very hot places like Dubai?
Yeah, correct. So the properties that are uniquely different to other building materials that we, let's say, traditionally compete with is traditional materials like made of metal, for instance, where their mass works essentially as a battery to energy during the day, heats up, and then over the afternoon or evening will emit that heat back into the building as well as into the surrounding environment. And it's a phenomenon that's been given a name now called an urban heat island effect, where our product is an insulating material with significant airflow through the material, which acts as a cooling agent. So by creating that physical barrier between the outside world and the building with a membrane type design, allows us to reduce the amount of solar energy entering the building during the day, and then at night it has a chance to cool back down.
So what sort of reductions can it make to either temperature or perhaps more, it's easier to imagine, the need for air conditioning? When in very hot climates will people be turning the air conditioning on? And how much less might they need to if they're using this product?
So 70% is the number we quote. So we did quite a series of tests with GNS here in Wellington. And they did a number of radiation tests passing through it and found that it essentially throughout the band of radiation, it's around 70%. So what that means is while 30% of energy passes through it, that's a significant reduction on energy hitting a building. And when you start calculating that reduction over the surface area of the building, it depends how much we cover, for instance, and which way it's facing, all has a unique change to the building's design, its position, etc. So we work with engineers to sort of work through that as well, because, you know, sometimes you want one, say the southern side in the southern hemisphere of the building, you know, you do want some energy gain on there, but the northern end, obviously, you wouldn't.
How is it used differently on the exteriors of buildings? In some instances, it's almost just providing, it's like a see-through fence, right? I'm looking at a car parking building here, or perhaps a connecting walkway between buildings. But on others, it appears to be almost a cladding on top of the cladding of the building.
Yes, correct. So it's again, in the hot climates, they're you know, attracted to our physical properties differently, say, than, for instance, the New Zealand market. So we tend to sort of promote sort of more the decorative or the hiding an ugly building type application here in New Zealand. But if you take it to a hot climate like the US or the Middle East, that's where they get significantly interested in how to do something creatively on the building, because it's also very malleable. So unlike a lot of traditional materials that have a rigidity, This is a highly flexible material, and it's what makes chainmail unique compared to all materials. And I suppose if you think about its origins, more than 2,000 years ago, because the true origin of chainmail is not really known. There's a few theories out there, but we can go back 2,000 years to know that that was definitely existing then. And where its true benefits are is its flexibility. So we're using that in a creative, artistic way, not just providing a, you know, a flat panel facade or a static building structure. We're bringing life to these buildings through allowing that movement to occur, or embracing the idea that we can deform the shape of it and make more of a three-dimensional finish, which is a good way to try and soften the hard and urban environment. You can do it quite simply by, you know, introducing a curve versus a square edge, for instance.
Does the material itself move? I've just been rewatching a video here where it appears to move. It almost appears to shimmer like, I don't know, a long flowing dress might move and shimmer.
Correct.
Does that not make noise, though? Do you not end up with rattly sounds?
No, you will if you're handling a sample in your hand and jingling it around, because gravity's all over the place on that sample. Once you hang this material, it's got enough static weight, essentially, that its natural weight pulls it all into a position. And so even when it's moving, you've still got gravity pulling forces on it so that the material itself doesn't jingle or make any sound. So it's quite a silent thing, which if you look on our website, there's a large video on the opening homepage of an entire car park in Ohio, Columbus, Ohio. And that moves, that's generated passively by wind. So it's a kinetic art installation. And for that, we collaborated with an American artist who's internationally renowned for kinetic works. His name is Ned Kahn. And that building makes no sound.
In some instances, the people not want to see the movement, however, because it can become quite transfixing. And is it possible to make it quite taut in a way where you don't see movement?
Yes. So part of the, I suppose, unlocking the puzzle, which was sort of what got me into this, is more about, you know, here's something that's been around for 2,000 years and parts. Essentially, it's made of lots of little rings. So people, a lot of people don't understand chainmail. It's essentially interlocking rings to create a two-dimensional surface of linked elements. So it's like chains, but lots of chains in every direction all interconnected with each other. So that allows the material to either be tensioned or hang loose like a fabric, like a dress. So, you know, fashion, apparel, costumery. Some of it's my experience of being introduced to chainmail was through costumery. And that actually is all about the movement. But you're right, and a lot of architectural applications we do, the material is put under tension, and quite significant tension at times as well. And that's how we unlocked it, by coming up with a methodology to produce it. So all the links themselves are solid shapes interlinked. So we assemble them in a liquid state, let's say. So there's no joints, which means then the material itself becomes a very tensile material that can be used for other applications as well.
People will want to know about the environmental factors involved here, understandably, as they always do now. And it's made of a high-grade engineering polycarbonate. What are the pros and cons of this as a material?
Good question. Yes, and you're right. You know, this is very much a question asked a lot now. But I did start the design process of producing this material nearly 20 years ago now. And at that point, even then, I was trying to think how to create a material without generating waste in the process. But that was an initial thinking, and obviously that's something we've carried on through right to the end. So, you know, we're proud to say that it is a nil-waste manufacturing process. But more importantly was when I started to investigate materials to work with. So the properties of different materials that we could harness in this process and put into this format of chainmail. And that's where polycarbonate just rose above all the other material options out there. I explored ceramics, aluminiums, alloys, and I kept coming back to this material, polycarbonate. And people probably know it best as things like bulletproof windows or aircraft windows, for instance, are made of the same material. So it's a translucent polymer. And unlike a lot of other plastics, or most other plastics, it's what they call a single-cell polymer, or single-molecule polymer, which allows us to keep it in a state of what they call full-circle material or full-circle manufacturing, otherwise known as cradle-to-cradle approach to manufacturing, which means we don't contaminate the material with any materials that can't be removed at the end of its life. So effectively, we could receive back a project that we delivered, say, 15, 20 years ago. We could take that material to the original producer, and they would reproduce an original virgin material from that, and with very little byproduct at all in that process. This is where industry in general, manufacturers, are trying to move to. It's quite hard to move there because most people mix materials for different properties, and we've chosen from the beginning not to mix these properties. And then the other one is its construction industry is our core market that we develop the product for. So you've got high performance applications for code compliance, you know, ranging from structural integrity time as well as things like fire performance. And that's where these, again, this particular material outperforms all of the other options. So we're pretty proud that we've managed to stay with this material because of the not only the full circle approach to what we produce, but the market now is starting to understand the benefits of this material. It's low energy requirements to produce it. So, you know, we're trying to, dislodge the hold that metal mesh products have got on the market and the architects go to all the time. But these materials use huge amounts of energy to be produced at the beginning. They do corrode and fail over time, like most materials do on buildings. So, and at the end of it, they need massive amounts of energy to reprocess them. So you do that a number of times and you add up the energy number for that for compared to a product like ours. And, you know, we're eight or ten times more the amount of energy being used just for the first cycle, let alone every cycle after that.
The durability, though, of this kind of product is one of the problems that the world is dealing with now. And so I'm curious in your stance on product stewardship, because something being recyclable is quite different from it being ultimately recycled. And are you, I'm not sure what the typical life, you mentioned 20 years might be for, I don't know, a building facade or a walkway facade. But then what happens? Is it built in? Is the recycling of it back to, I don't know if you can get your virginity back, but anyway, back to largely virgin material?
Well, no, you can.
Yeah.
And with this material, you can. And this is what I maybe didn't explain very well. So there's a lot of materials that we're all very tuned into the plastic messaging out there, and I'm totally a part of that. In fact, I've collaborated and worked with Ocean Cleanup. You may not be familiar with them. They're a Dutch company that's deploying systems into the Pacific garbage patch.
Very, very well familiar with them. I'm trying to get head back to talk to me again, so give him a nudge, will you?
Okay.
Young guy in his early 20s, eh?
It depends who you're dealing with, but I deal with a few of them there, including the R&D director as well. So we've done a number of works with them on that particular factor, and their knowledge around materials like polycarbonate, for instance, are extremely advanced. So, you know, they appreciate the values it brings. You know, and I can confidently say there is no polycarbonate floating around in the ocean. It's just not possible because it doesn't float. But park that aside. Obviously, there's management of materials at the end of life, etc. So the raw material demand for even recycled polycarbonate is extremely high because of its high value. You know, it's many times more to buy as a raw material than, you know, your commodity consumer plastics, which are the ones that are actually, I think, are causing the most problem because of consumer behavior not keeping control of these materials and releasing them into the environment. We have a very closed loop process to manufacturing, as well as the process of when we do get material back, and it's still something we, you know, we wait for, then we have those relationships in place with the original manufacturers that can take this material back to a virgin state. So whilst most people talk recycling, we actually go one step further in that, as we want to bring it back to the original state. Because recycling only works one or two times, and then eventually it all ends up in a furnace or a landfill.
All right, so you actually melt it back to liquid state, or you would do when you start getting them, right? Because
We personally wouldn't. That would be the supplier of those raw materials. They want it back because there's a demand for it, because it saves you going and getting raw materials again. And this is all made from byproducts of other industries.
I'm curious as to whether the product stewardship is built in. You're telling me there are incentives for it to happen, but as an example, I guess, of where we might want to see a lot of products go, is it built in at point of sale? I know different jurisdictions have different rules on this, but as it stands now...
We don't have to build that in, per se, because the manufacturers would buy it from us.
Okay. Where is it going to be? Where is it right now? And can you describe what's happening in Dubai at Expo 2020, now being held in 2021?
Yeah.
Just describe what's on display there that's yours.
Okay, so we've got two significant installations at the World Expo. The first one that came across our desk of opportunity, I suppose you could say, was the actual main entrance shade canopy. And that came through from the Dubai World Trade Center was the client, and they were working with an architectural firm we've done work with in the past called Woods Bagot. They're an Australian-based company, but now they're global. In fact, I think they now have an office in New Zealand. So the architects and the consultants, the engineering consultants approached Kmail. They had been looking at several other materials coming out of Europe, and they'd undertaken field testing in the desert, and this testing identified that these materials weren't robust enough for the application. They were quite familiar with our work in the US, in particular some large-scale kinetic facades that are moving all the time and have been up there for about 10 years now. So they knew we had the performance capability, and we had the time-proven, I suppose, examples out there in the commercial space. So they came to us, and we collaborated on the design of the big shade canopy that sits over the entire main entrance to the World Expo. It's around 12,000 square meters, the material itself that was supplied for that. And it's been a very successful installation as far as exposure to the technology, you know, a New Zealand made technology, but also it's what has been dubbed the WonderCool properties. Because of its sort of wondrous cooling capability, especially in these hot climates. And, you know, being that this hangs or sits over the main entrance, the security passing, there's queuing people, you know, it was really important to create an environment as shaded from this desert sun as possible. And I don't think, unless you've been there, many people quite understand how hot 50 degrees is when the environment you're in might be 50 degrees, but the radiant energy coming off the buildings might be 80 or 90. You know, you can burn your hand when you touch a steel element in those conditions. So that's where they were very interested in the thermal properties. That's our biggest sort of most high profile, I suppose, globally installation. The one that we're very proud of as Kiwis is being involved in the New Zealand Pavilion itself. And in that case, we've produced the facade around the building itself. And again, that building will be benefiting from these solar reduction properties.
Someone asking, I think you've already touched on this, about fire resistance.
Oh, yes. Sure. So that's a really hot topic globally, especially for building facades. And there's quite rigorous large-scale fire testing, et cetera, that you have to undertake, for instance, to enter the US market or any markets now. And so we've invested significantly over the years into undertaking these large tests. You know, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars tests. And they're significant. You know, every local fire chief wants to review the tests. And, you know, essentially you don't get on a building now unless it's been through quite a rigorous third-party evaluation. So we're a non-propagating material. So that allows us to go into high population environments, multi-story buildings, etc. It's quite a unique thing actually for our material, because a lot of our competitors that produce sort of traditional panels, they can't get into these markets.
Kane, what was your background? We talked about obviously the initial idea was costumes when you were working on Lord of the Rings, and you saw the chainmail costumes used on the and thought back to their use in the Middle Ages. But that's one thing. It's quite a step to being at the level of production you're at now in a complex material and with all these other matters attached. Do you have an engineering background, or what is your background, do you think, that has contributed to being able to get things to this point?
That's a good question. Not sure there's a straight answer for that either. Just to be clear, so whilst on working for Weta Workshop, my primary job, whilst the title's Artistic Director of Creature Armour and Weapons, my primary job for the first year was essentially taking sketches or drawings, looking at them and trying to figure out what methodology we could use to produce them physically for the day of shoot. And that involved going around the country, going into facilities, production environments, especially around here in Wellington. You know, we had quite a healthy capability happening there, and it is depleting, which is a bit worrying. It's a concern of mine. And they were so open to allow me to go and look at their processes that I sort of got insight into how all these various manufacturing processes were working, but I was coming from a perspective that didn't look at the barriers but was trying to find opportunity that we in the film industry could benefit from on these big films, because there was no way Weta could produce everything. We knew we had to farm out projects essentially to local capability. So I think that certainly helped. My background, you know, came through the sort of more practical cabinet making, joinery, boat building space. So, you know, that makes you think outside of a square box when you work in a ship. Nothing's square, nothing's level. So, you know, it pushes you to sort of, I suppose, not see going beyond the norm as a barrier, more as an opportunity to discover new things. And that's essentially led me to this. You know, after the filming was resolved, and for instance, for the film, the chainmail I came up with there was actually, people were sitting there assembling plastic plumbing tube links. But the sort of the eureka moment was figuring out how to put silver onto it, like real silver, in a process that held it together and made it look like metal. And I thought that was really interesting, and a lot of people wanted to keep their tunics. Like, it became quite attached to them. And I thought, well, with that much of attachment, it's a real tactile material. It has properties that no other product does. Commercially, surely there's other applications. And what really got me going was I played around with some ideas around oil spill recovery in particular, and I could see some properties and benefits for that. So the next step was, you know, whilst it could demonstrate it could perform well in that environment, how do we make it so that it's not so either manually assembled or produced? And that just essentially led me to starting to try and design a machine. You know, and then one thing led to the next, and now we have one.
Very basic question from a listener. How do you keep this material clean? Over time, the chainmail will collect dust.
Yeah, you can water blast it is a simple way, or just through movement, especially anywhere that you allow it to move, then it doesn't really allow accumulation. For instance, the facade on our building here, I think it's been washed once in about 8 years. And so if you got up really close, like any building material, every building is covered in dust. It's just the nature of our environment we live in. And any surface that sits with a flat edge is going to allow dust to accumulate. So the benefit of this is it moves. So again, the competitor products are woven steel materials. They don't move. And yes, it is a problem for products that don't move.
Just finally, I mean, what's the scale of production coming out of Petone? I know it's mainly international contracts at the moment, but even a single contract, you know, a single building facade is quite a lot of material to be exporting over quite some distance. And as you look forward and you hope demand grows, what's the plan?
For production, so the technology is a way of describing the various machines that are involved in the process. So from the beginning, I thought automation has to be the key to unlocking this 2,000-year-old puzzle, because I'd seen people manually assembling, you know, hundreds of hours to make a tiny square. It is an incredibly laborious process. A lot of people enjoy it as a form of meditation. You know, the monks were the original ones to produce it. They're the only ones that were patient enough and had the skills. So, you know, there is something meditative about it. But, you know, to produce at scale, as you said, you know, you need to think beyond that sort of satisfactory process of meditation. So that's where automation comes in. And a number of the machines that have all been produced here in New Zealand, in fact, everything's produced here in New Zealand, machines and process and products. We don't import any of that. The key for that is how to run those machines effectively. And that's something over the last 15 years of development and running these things under significant demand, you know, 24/7. We ran for multiple months to produce the canopy because the timeline was so short. That's where the real value, long-term value sits. Whilst you can have patents in place, that's only a right to defend. It's not really a good, strong strategy for protecting your idea, unless of course you want to sell it. So we very much are focused on maintaining the IP here tightly held so that the production process is very scalable. I have local manufacturing firms that we have relationships with that have, you know, from time to time are struggling to find enough work to keep their people employed and their machines busy. So, you know, we can utilize the wider capability around us. And that's the expansion plan for the business as well. It's not about getting more people in our workshop, you know, working. It's about all the smaller capability companies around us here in Petone, for instance, where we would rather outsource to them, keep that capability available for us, because we balloon on projects and then, you know, subside between. So architecturally, you're right. A big project can be a significant project for the company. Whilst we keep the little interior stuff sort of chugging along in the background, the really big projects are the ones that make the difference for our business. And that's where we call upon that network of resource capability around us to allow us to deliver it. And without that, we probably wouldn't have been able to deliver the canopy in time.
Thanks very much, Kane Horsham.